ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Good morning. Welcome to AM. It's Friday, the 22nd of March. I'm Sabra Lane, coming to you from Nipaluna, Hobart. School principals have reported witnessing or experiencing the highest levels of violence, threats and bullying recorded ever in a long-running survey of school leaders. More than half of the principals questioned say poor behaviour and increasing workloads were leaving them ready to quit the profession. Here's National Education and Parenting reporter Connor Duffy.
For the last 13 years, the Australian Catholic University has taken a national snapshot of the health of the principals entrusted with the education of 4 million school children. Report lead Dr. Paul Kidson is a former principal himself and was shocked by the increasing levels of violence at school. 48% reported experiencing or witnessing violence, the highest total yet, and a 77% increase from the first survey in 2011.
I've had one story that came to me of a child who grabbed hair of a teacher and literally pulled a clump of hair out. I've had principals who have physically had parents poke their fingers in their chest, you know, demanding that they ought to do things, standing over them in public environments.
Dr. Kidson says the violence includes breaking up fights involving students, as well as direct attacks from parents or their children. He says about 54% of principals also reported threats of violence.
Some of the threats also tend to be in emails, text messages, as much as they are face-to-face. So if I get an email at 11:30 at night and then by 10 to 8 in the morning I've got a cranky parent on the phone saying, why haven't you responded to what I sent you last night? That's a fundamentally unreasonable expectation.
That and increasing administrative workloads have left 56% of the 2,300 principals who took the survey considering early retirement or leaving the profession. Dr. Kidson says if even half of that number proceed, it would be very difficult to replace them.
Now, we're already 4,000 teachers under where we need to be, according to the Commonwealth Government. How that would actually be compounded by the absence of those 500 principals is difficult to fathom, but there is no doubt that it would have extraordinary impact on the nation and their children.
The highest levels of violence were reported in the Northern Territory and the Australian Capital Territory. Robin Powell is the president of the Northern Territory Principals Association. She says while more than 95% of interactions with parents were positive, the exceptions could be shocking.
Unfortunately and sadly, at times people are faced with machetes, with spears, with knives, which is quite concerning. And I wonder how many other people in their day-to-day jobs get exposed to that level of violence.
Ms. Powell assists school leaders dealing with the fallout and says more support is needed.
We can put the school into a lockdown and call the police, but sometimes in our communities, police aren't on duty. So you have that feeling of a bit more vulnerability.
In a statement, the Education Minister, Jason Clare, said all principals and teachers should be safe at work. He said the current teacher shortage was 10 years in the making and the government was working on solutions with the states, teacher unions and principals.
Connor Duffy reporting. Technology giant Apple has been hit by a massive antitrust case in the United States targeting its signature product, the iPhone. The Department of Justice and more than a dozen US states have filed a lawsuit alleging the tech giant throttles competition and thwarts innovation, ultimately harming consumers. North America correspondent Barbara Miller filed this report.
In Shanghai, some people lined up overnight to see another Apple store being opened, using their iPhones to take selfies with the company's CEO, Tim Cook, who smiled and made a victory sign. In Washington, US authorities were announcing blockbuster legal action against Apple, alleging the company has monopolized the smartphone market.
Good morning. Earlier today, the Department of Justice, joined by 15 states and the District of Columbia, sued Apple in the US District Court for the District of New Jersey for violating Section 2 of the Sherman Antitrust Act.
Attorney General Merrick Garland said Apple's tactics hurt consumers and competitors.
For consumers, that has meant fewer choices, higher prices and fees, lower quality smartphones, apps and accessories, and less innovation from Apple and its competitors. For developers, that has meant being forced to play by rules that insulate Apple from competition.
The Attorney General said ultimately everyone loses by what's known as a walled garden design.
We allege that Apple has consolidated its monopoly power, not by making its own products better, but by making other products worse.
It's the latest push by US authorities to crack down on the reach of big tech, which began under the Trump administration. Tim Wu is a professor at Columbia Law School who previously served as an advisor to President Biden on tech and antitrust issues. He spoke to CNBC.
The idea, I think, is to hold America's best companies' feet to the fire, that if they're forced to compete, they get better, that dominant companies become stagnant. It's an American tradition. We did it with IBM, we did it with AT&T, we did it with Microsoft.
In the US, Apple successfully fought off an antitrust case over its App Store policies by Epic, the maker of the popular game Fortnite. Legal action against Apple and Google by Epic in Australia was on hold pending outcomes in the US, but is now being heard by the federal court in Melbourne. The tech giant was also fined $3 billion by European regulators earlier this month for thwarting competition in the music streaming business. Apple's described the latest legal action in the US as wrong on the facts and the law and has vowed to vigorously fight it. This is Barbara Miller in Washington reporting for AM.
Australia will give almost $5 billion to British industry during the next decade as part of the AUKUS agreement, and that funding announcement's been revealed ahead of high-level talks in Adelaide today between the two nations. AUKUS is the defence partnership between Australia, the United Kingdom and the United States to help Australia acquire nuclear-powered subs. Defence correspondent Andrew Green reports from Adelaide.
At the Prime Minister's official Canberra residence, Anthony Albanese welcomes high-powered guests from the United Kingdom.
Hi, Secretary. How are you going?
I'm good. How are you?
Good, good. Welcome.
All right, thank you. Thank you very much.
British Defence Secretary Grant Shapps and Foreign Secretary David Cameron are here to hold formal talks with their Australian counterparts. Last night, after their dinner with the Prime Minister, the visiting politicians flew to Adelaide, where they'll first head to the Osborne shipyards to unveil further details of the massive AUKUS submarine endeavour. Defence Minister Richard Marles says the publicly owned ASC will team up with British defence giant BAE Systems in a new commercial venture to build Australia's future SSN AUKUS fleet.
This is another major step in the delivery of AUKUS. The announcement of the commercial build arrangements for SSN AUKUS at the Osborne Naval Shipyard in Adelaide demonstrates that this is moving apace.
As part of the plan, Australian taxpayers will contribute $4.6 billion over a decade towards design work on the new nuclear-powered submarines and to expand a Rolls-Royce plant that builds the radioactive reactors. Secretary Shapps says the deteriorating strategic environment justifies the massive spending.
Nuclear-powered submarines are not cheap, but we live in a much more dangerous world where we are seeing a much more assertive region, China, a much more dangerous world all around with what's happening in the Middle East and Europe.
The huge injection of Australian financial support into the UK's submarine sector matches a similar taxpayer-funded payment to the United States to help expand its industrial base. US Ambassador Caroline Kennedy.
There's been bipartisan support for this. There's significant investment in the United States, and we're looking forward to the visit to Osborne.
Not everyone's celebrating. Green Senator and AUKUS critic David Shoebridge says it's clear Australia is helping to prop up a failing UK submarine industry.
There's no way the UK could afford to build their next generation of nuclear subs without finding some sucker like Australia on the other side of the planet who will chip in billions and billions and billions of dollars to that industry. I think this is a very real concern for Australian taxpayers.
Later today, the visiting British Defence and Foreign Secretaries will sit down with their Australian hosts, Richard Marles and Penny Wong, for the annual AUKMIN Summit. This year's talks are again expected to focus on the war in Ukraine and China's rapid military rise in this region.
Andrew Green reporting there. Tasmanians are voting in a state election tomorrow, and it's shaping up as an unpredictable contest. Polls suggest neither major party is on track to win the 18 seats needed for a majority government, with the next administration likely to need support from a crossbench of MPs to govern. Thousands of Tasmanians have already voted, and our reporter Alexandra Humphreys spoke with some of them in Hobart's northern suburbs.
There's a steady stream of people heading into a pre-poll station in Moona to cast their ballots. It's in the Tasmanian electorate of Clark, which takes in central Hobart and surrounding suburbs. Speaking to them, certain issues jump right out.
But it's definitely health and cost of living here. That's terrible. So.
Well, the cost of living, healthcare, youth crime.
Probably the cost of living.
Yeah, a lot of young ones, you know, with children, it must be terribly hard.
The major parties have released plenty of policies aimed at addressing the cost of living on housing, electricity, public transport and even free school lunches. Kim Goods is a director of 3P Advisory, which conducts monthly community sentiment surveys across Tasmania on social and economic issues.
There's no doubt that the top three issues for most Tasmanians is cost of living, followed closely by health and housing affordability.
In Tasmania's southern electorates, another big issue has overshadowed the campaign. In a deal the Liberal government signed with the AFL, getting Tasmania's long-desired footy team is contingent on building a new stadium in Hobart. The Liberals have promised to cap spending on it at $375 million. Labor wants to renegotiate the deal entirely, something the AFL says it won't do.
I don't want a stadium. I don't feel that we need a stadium. I think we need so many more things. When people don't have a roof over their head, stadium is the last thing we need.
The stadium for the youth, for the kids. I think it's very selfish if we don't do this now.
So you think we do need a stadium?
Oh, I think we certainly need it.
The Tasmanian AFL team has already signed up more than 120,000 foundation members since its launch on Monday. Despite the team's popularity, Kim Goods believes the stadium isn't a top issue for voters, but it is on their minds.
I think many Tasmanians who are really feeling the bite of cost of living are really struggling to access good health care and struggling to afford rent or mortgage payments will have the stadium as a secondary issue.
Tasmania's Liberal government is seeking an unprecedented fourth term in office. Labor leader Rebecca White is fighting her third election as opposition leader. There's added uncertainty this time, though. The expansion of state parliament from 25 to 35 seats will likely mean independent and minor party candidates find it easier to get elected. The Greens and the Jackie Lambie Network are looking to capitalise on the change, as are several high-profile independents. Kim Goods thinks voters are open to seeing more faces on the crossbench.
Certainly in the data and the testing I've got, it would show there is a mood for change and that independents are definitely considered viable option for a lot of Tasmanians.
Back at Moona's pre-poll station, voters are flooding in from across the political spectrum.
I've always voted Liberal, but this year I've changed to the Greens and so have all of my friends who've never voted Greens before.
Labor. Stuck with them all the way.
I voted Liberal.
A bit of both, to be honest.
Oh yeah, a ticket all over the place.
Exactly. Based on individual kind of policies and commitments.
Political analyst Richard Herr expects whoever forms Tasmania's next government will need to negotiate with smaller parties and independents.
If the Liberal Party were only to need three or so on the crossbench to form a government and Labor needed five, it would be a lot easier for the Liberals to make that negotiation than it would be for Labor.
This election was called a year early because the Liberal government was in minority. Tasmania's next government might have to deal with an even more uncertain parliament after Saturday, while addressing an economy under pressure and a precarious budgetary position.
Alexandra Humphreys reporting there. We invited Liberal Premier Jeremy Rockcliffe to join us today to answer your questions about the state's future and about the policies he's promising to deliver. 5 weeks ago, we offered live or pre-recorded interviews to both the major party leaders, and Labor's Rebecca White joined us yesterday. Mr. Rockcliffe's office declined our offer yesterday, saying he had other commitments. A politician who is everywhere but not standing herself is Federal Senator Jackie Lambie. She has a number of candidates running in the campaign under the Jackie Lambie Network banner. She joined me earlier. Jackie Lambie, forecasting a winner with Tasmania's system of voting is pretty tricky. Some believe that you might end up as kingmaker in a hung parliament. Some others are not sure you'll win any seats. What do you think?
Well, you know what, Sabra? What I know is that my guys have worked their butts off. They're standing at street corners waving at people. They're standing at traffic lights. Because what we do know is we don't take those big political donations, so we just can't compete against them with money. So you have to go out and earn it. And I think they've certainly earned at least one seat in every electorate. There is no doubt that we are running in, and that's 4 out of the 5 of them. They have worked, mate. They are normal people. They've had real life experience out there. And I just, if you want people like me in Parliament with real life experience, then God forbid, have a good look at these runners that I've put out there for you. They're good people. They're good, hearty people, families, all that stuff. They've done it tough during their lifetimes. That's what's on offer here.
If there is a hung Parliament, your MPs, if you get them elected, have a say in deciding who governs, what role will you play in helping make that decision?
What I will do is I will be just a step back and I will share with them my knowledge, my experience, my contacts if they need them. That's what I will do. And, I will say, this is what happens if you go this way. This is probably what's going to happen. So I'm going to share that. But ultimately, it will be their choice. It's not me that sits in Parliament, in State Parliament, that has to work with them. It will be the candidates that get up.
Could you negotiate with Jeremy Rockcliffe, given that he's called an early election saying that minority government's been unworkable and it's been destabilising, destroys confidence and it's not good for Tasmania? Is that a fair summation?
Well, it's destabilised because they've had 10 years to fix everything and we've got worse in Tasmania. That's what it comes down to. So, once again, I don't know what the mix looks like. There could be independents up there. We may get 2, we may get 4. I really can't answer that. But once again, it is up to them. But they've also, like I have, watched Jeremy Rockcliffe's behaviour over the last 4 to 6 weeks and it's been atrocious. They know that. These guys have values. They've come from backgrounds, they've got real life experience, they're not idiots, so they can see all this playing out in front of them. They're like, oh my goodness, you can't be serious. So I just don't think Jeremy Rockcliffe has helped himself at all. He's certainly made it harder. What they do know, though, and what they're worried about even more, is that it is a very known thing down here that Jeremy Rockcliffe does not intend to do 4 years. So does that put Michael Ferguson in? If Eric Abetzger is in, are they going to have to work with him? So this is all the instability that's going on down here at the moment. I mean, for goodness sakes, the way we're going could be back at another election within the next 2 years.
How much vetting have you done of your candidates? Are you confident that they can work together if they're all elected and not go rogue?
What I do know is that they've already been out there. We've had some of them that ran in federal. They've been around us for 3 years. We did not run 7 people in each electorate for that very reason. I wanted 3 and 3 only. That's it. So they got to know each other personally. They've all been out there. Apart from one of them that we picked up at Christmas time, they've all known each other for probably 6 or 7 months, and not to mention the 2 that we had beforehand that ran with us that have now been with us for 3 years.
State net debt here is $18,000 per person. Should that be a priority for the next government? Do you have a view on how that should be paid off with either new taxes or cuts in government spending?
I'll tell you what's not going to pay it off, a brand new stadium. So, when you've got hospital ramping out there, when we've got a health system that is on its knees, when we have kids that are now, we are not going past grade 10, when I can see small business out there suffering, when I can see people that in the supermarkets that are sitting there nearly crying in front of me when I'm walking through mine in Burnie, and they're crying, say, I can hardly afford to feed my kids. I'm missing a meal. This is where we're at. Once upon a time, I could ring housing in Tasmania and be able to get emergency accommodation for someone that come into my office. Mate, I can't even do that. My office can't even do that. That's how bad it is down here.
Jackie Lambie, thanks for your time on AM.
Thank you so much for having me on.
That's Senator Jackie Lambie. That's AM for today. Thanks for your company. I'm Sabra Lane.
Hi, I'm Sam Hawley, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. When one of China's most senior figures came to Australia this week, it was one unofficial meeting that really stuck out. Wang Yi was very keen to meet former Prime Minister Paul Keating. Today, Foreign Affairs reporter Stephen Jedgetts on what China's playing at. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.